From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Comic Jim Gaffigan is preparing to perform this weekend for over a million people at the Festival of Families, which Pope Francis is expected to attend.
I think I might be opening for the Pope Mobile driving in, but I'll be doing 20 minutes of stand-up after Aretha Franklin.
Today we talk with Gaffigan about how he's preparing and about his TV series in which he plays a comic named Jim Gaffigan who, like the real Gaffigan, doesn't swear in his act and is a Catholic.
In the show, I'm a cultural Catholic. In real life, I'm somebody who goes to church. I mean, I should clarify, I'm a horrible person. I need the concept of mercy to have some semblance of self-admiration.
And Lloyd Schwartz reviews the first complete recording of the musical The Golden Apple.
Support for NPR comes from Bleecker Street, presenting the new film Pawn Sacrifice. In a gripping true story set during the height of the Cold War, American chess prodigy Bobby Fischer, played by Tobey Maguire, finds himself caught between two superpowers when he challenges the Soviet Empire. Also starring Liev Schreiber and Peter Sarsgaard, Pawn Sacrifice chronicles Fischer's terrifying struggles with genius and madness, and the rise and fall of a kid from Brooklyn who captured the imagination of the world. Now playing.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I do want everyone to feel comfortable. That's why I'd like to talk to you about Jesus. He better not. It doesn't matter if you're religious or not. Does anything make you feel more uncomfortable than some stranger going, I'd like to talk to you about Jesus? Yeah, I'd like you not to. You could say that to the Pope. I want to talk to you about Jesus. You'd be like, easy, freak. I keep work at work. I have to admit, that was a good impression of the Pope.
That's comic Jim Gaffigan, recorded in 2005. Pope Francis might actually hear Gaffigan perform on Saturday in Philadelphia, where Gaffigan and Aretha Franklin will be among the performers at the Festival of Families, which the Pope is expected to attend after his papal parade. Gaffigan has made his Catholicism a central part of his comedy in his stand-up act and in his TV series, The Jim Gaffigan Show, which had its first season finale last night on TV Land. Gaffigan is the author of two books, each focusing on other subjects he talks about a lot in his act. Dad is Fat is about being the father of five children. Food, a Love Story is about eating a lot. On his TV series, he plays a stand-up comic named Jim Gaffigan, who, like the real Gaffigan, is married, has five children, and is Catholic. But in the series, Gaffigan tries to keep a pretty low profile about his faith, until the Huffington Post prominently features him in a story headlined Entertainers of Faith. His always sarcastic friend, played by Michael Ian Black, discovers the article while visiting Gaffigan and his wife.
What is this picture of you holding a Bible the size of a child's coffin doing on the Huffington Post?
Let me see this.
Congratulations, you made the front page, right next to a story about Miley Cyrus's tongue.
Entertainers of faith. Funny man Jim Gaffigan isn't ashamed of his Catholicism. He's seen here leaving the New York Comedy Club with his Bible in hand.
What are they talking about?
I know, they lost me at Funny Man.
Oh no, I've been outed as a Christian.
What is wrong with that?
Well, I don't want people to think I believe in God.
But you do believe in God.
Yeah, but that's my private business. Besides, the perception is that people that believe in God are stupid.
Oh, I don't think that's true.
Your signature bit is you singing Hot Pockets and suddenly you're worried about people thinking you're stupid?
No, really, this is serious business. I don't want to get involved in the culture war. Religion's iffy. Once you identify yourself as believing something, you open yourself to ridicule.
You're being completely paranoid. Just because you believe in a Jesus that looks like Chris Hemsworth doesn't mean people are going to think they're better than you. They got plenty of other reasons for that.
Come on, Daniel. You don't believe in some sort of higher power.
You think God made man in his image?
I'm a target now.
I know. A mighty big one, too.
That's a scene from the Jim Gaffigan Show. Jim Gaffigan, welcome to Fresh Air. And I should mention, further into that scene, you get calls from the White House inviting you to the annual prayer breakfast. Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, wants to debate you. Joel Osteen wants to take you to dinner. I'm sure you wrote all that before you got the call asking you to perform with the Pope in the audience for the World Meeting of Families during the Pope's visit to Philadelphia. So what is it you're being asked to do?
Well, I'm being asked to perform stand-up comedy for the World Meeting or the World Festival of Families prior to the Pope's arrival. I believe it's – I think I might be opening for the Pope Mobile driving in. But I'll be doing 20 minutes of stand-up after Aretha Franklin. it just gets more and more obscure. And of course, you know, the clip from the show, there's a couple episodes in the show that kind of deal with, my fear surrounding, being exposed as a Catholic or we have a whole episode about how Jim is terrified to perform in front of a priest. We present it as comedy poison. And now, of course, I'll be performing in front of the leader of 1.2 billion Catholics. So
is he going to be in the audience or not? I'm unclear about that.
I don't know. This is such a unique situation. I'm kind of flattered to be asked. And I assume I don't know what security reasons, might. I mean, obviously, he doesn't have to worry about me, but I don't know if they're having him downstairs or if he's arriving after I do the show. I don't know.
Do you know how many people are going to be there?
Well, I've heard 1.5 million, but which...
About the size of a comedy cellar.
Yeah, right. It's, comedy is this art form that's constructed on intimacy. It's a conversation. And so... I don't know. I can't even contemplate. I can't even reach out to another comedian who's done a similar event to this. I mean, Kevin Hart did the Eagles football stadium, but we're talking about a difference of 900,000 people here probably.
So how is this set that you're performing for, not only a Catholic audience, but a Catholic audience who's gathered to meet the Pope? And possibly the Pope himself. How is this set going to compare to the sets that you typically do at comedy clubs?
It's people, you nailed it right there. It's like people are not coming to see Jim Gaffigan. They're coming to see Pope Francis and hear what Pope Francis has to say. I don't have any expectations. There's different kind of humorous takes on it. I don't imagine I will have a negative impact. I hope people don't come to the event and say, I was a Catholic, but after I saw that Jim Gaffigan guy, I'm thinking of switching to Protestant. I don't think that's an issue. But I also, maybe me doing this set, when the decision of letting me into heaven, they might be like, well, he was a horrible guy, but he did do that gig for the Pope, so maybe we'll let him in. I think it's such an enormous idea of, of a show for a comedian that I don't know how to comprehend it. I just am hoping to not ruin this special experience for everyone else.
Yeah, you had a very funny tweet you wrote. I can't believe the Pope is staying in my apartment tomorrow night. Should I get extra bugles?
Yes, because who doesn't like bugles?
Yeah,
right?
Really.
And they're shaped a little bit like a Pope hat. So.
So in the clip that we heard, the Jim Gaffigan that you play on your TV show, it is very uncomfortable with being outed as a Catholic. And he's afraid that that it's going to hurt his comic identity and that people will project things on him, that it's going to lead to trouble. Were you uncomfortable with audience or the press finding out that you were practicing Catholic?
Yeah, I mean, well, my wife and I, we worked together and we wrote this book, Dad is Fat. And in the book, I was encouraged constantly by my editor to be more personal and talk about more personal experiences. So we wrote about having five kids and bringing them to church. A journalist at the Washington Post wrote this article where the headline was "The New Catholic Evangelism of Jim Gaffigan." And it was a bit terrifying. I spent most of my adult life essentially agnostic or an atheist, and I am somebody who my path to my faith is very kind of individual, and I don't want to be lumped into the category of you know, those Westboro Baptists. It's like my faith is very personal. It's not something that I want to project on other people, but some of my fear and anxiety surrounding it, I think, provides some good comedy for my act.
Let's play an example of that in your TV show, The Jim Gavigan Show on TV Land. Further into the episode that we heard an excerpt of earlier, after the article about you was written in the Huffington Post, after you're profiled as one of the entertainers of faith, you get a call to meet with a corporate executive who has an offer to make you. So here you are with the corporate executive.
Mr. Gaffigan.
Oh, hi.
Kevin Ferguson. I'm an executive at Kane Corp.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Never heard of it?
No.
We operate a chain of restaurants called Pizza House.
Make your house a pizza house.
That's us. We're looking for a new spokesperson.
Oh, that's very flattering, but I'm already doing this water campaign, so I don't want to do too many commercials.
Water campaign, that sounds fun.
Yeah.
2 days in Florida with us, seven figures.
I could go to the airport right now if you want.
Our CEO loves you.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. He likes my comedy?
Well, he hasn't seen your comedy, but he likes that you work clean and you have five kids. Jim, you'd be the perfect person to represent our company and reflect our American values, like pro-community.
That's me.
Pro-family.
That's me.
The repudiation of homosexuality.
That's not me.
So that's probably a pretty good example of what you're afraid of, that people will associate you with values that you don't share.
Yeah. You know, I grew up in a Catholic family in the Midwest, and I knew people of different faiths and people that were atheists and people that were agnostic, and it really never came up. But I think that in present-day America, there, you know, and I touched on it in the initial clip, is that we are in the middle of this culture war. And there's a quote in this episode where I say, I just want to talk about avocados. And some of it is, I do just want to do jokes. I don't want to be a divisive figure. I don't want to pick a team. I want to make people laugh and hopefully bring some, be humorous about the human experience, you know, whether there are people of any stripes of life.
There's an episode in your TV show, The Jim Gaffigan Show, where your priest, who's from Zimbabwe, is so impressed that you're a comic, and in one episode, in this episode, he accompanies you to a comedy club because his wife has kind of invited him to go with you. You really don't want him to come because, first of all, you're embarrassed to be seen with a priest and to be seen as so overtly religious. But also, you're afraid the priest is going to be exposed to things that's going to make him really uncomfortable, like curses and foul language. And so he says to you that he saw soldiers burn down his village in Zimbabwe. And then you say to him, yeah, but did they curse?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm wondering if you have a priest similar to this priest who has been exposed to all kinds of things that most of us have not.
Well, the priest that married my wife and I is actually from India. But, you know, there is something about people that come from what might be considered a third world country or our third world countries, that, you know, it's the classic first world problem stuff, that when we're dealing with some of our you know, American kind of paranoias about, like, oh, there's going to be cursing in front of a priest, that, you know, my wife and I, we wanted to kind of, you know, like, look, these are human beings. And some of our worries and concerns in the U.S. or a comedian are really trivial compared to what other people are dealing with in other countries.
So, you know, in the TV show, like, your wife is especially religious and you're, like, not much of a churchgoer. The first time you go, the priest is surprised because he didn't even realize your wife still had a husband.
Yeah.
Because he hadn't seen you before. Are you a churchgoer?
I am. I would say I'm in the show, I'm a cultural Catholic, which is what I was. And I would say that now I'm somebody who goes to church. I mean, I should clarify. Some of my anxiety is, like, I'm a horrible person. I need, you know, I need the concept of mercy for me to have some semblance of self-admiration. So In real life, I'm probably somebody who is more devout. That's not to say that I'm a well-informed Catholic. You know, I'm still an idiot. You know, like, I know that Colbert could quote Thomas Aquinas and all this, but I'm somebody who, you know, because it's a necessity for me on a personal basis. I need it because I'm a lunatic.
When you say you're a horrible person and a lunatic, what do you mean?
I mean that I'm somebody that, you know, I think stand-up comedy is this, it's this kind of indulgence and narcissism. And you're on stage, and because stand-up comedy is one of the few meritocracies in the entertainment industry, there's some kind of, at least for me, this some kind of idea of control. And my faith kind of keeps me in touch with the idea that I'm not in control of things. And when I'm in touch with the idea that there is a higher power and that there is, you know, other factors at work, it kind of quells my narcissism. And a lot of the teachings really kind of keep me grounded. But, you know, the reason I say I'm a horrible person is I don't want myself to be presented as somebody who's a great Catholic. You know, it's, you know, the idea of being a practicing Catholic, it's, for me, it's like I need a lot of practice. You know what I mean? So I don't, so I do get nervous. So even being presented as, you know, somebody who will be performing at this event, there's a little bit of concern or an expectation that I'm going to get a call and they're going to say, look, we did some research. You know, you really shouldn't be performing. But, you know, if you want to pick up garbage after the show, maybe we could have you do that. So
when you were growing up, did you grow up with the concept of mercy?
I don't think so. I think I grew up with the idea that God was a punishing being constructed around rules. And so he was, you know, this father figure that, you know, I was in trouble with, you know, constantly. And so it was not something that, I lived across from a Catholic church for 15 years that I never went into. And then I got married to my wife and, you know, now we're going in there every other day baptizing a kid. So it's an amazing journey, you know. You know, it's interesting because I was watching this thing last night. I think CNN had a thing on it. And it made me realize that, you know, for like the past 20 years, there has been this belief among the Catholic community, and this, I'm no expert, this is my opinion, that cafeteria Catholics are wrong. It's, you either, follow all the rules or you're not really Catholic. And I think what Pope Francis is saying is that nobody's perfect, you know, and so someone like Joe Biden, you know, where, you know, when he was running for president, people were, you know, there were some bishops that were like, don't let him have the Eucharist. And Pope Francis is saying that's not the point of this, you know, so.
So you grew up in a Catholic family. You became an agnostic at about what age?
I would say in my mid-20s.
So it, yeah. So you stayed with the church pretty long by agnostic standards.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, you know, I mean, that's, you know, the, you know, there's, that's why I think they're called cultural Catholics. It's, you know, I mean, I, you know, I was still rooting for Notre Dame. You know, it's like there's the cultural Catholic experience. I mean, I went to a Catholic university and, you know, there's something about the being a Catholic American. You know, St. Patrick's Day is, you know, I'm Irish Catholic. You know, there's alcoholism in my family. It's like I got to be Catholic, right? And so I think when I started doing stand-up, that's when I really tried to question everything in my belief system, you know, which is, I think, a pretty important part of being a comedian is really questioning things. And so that's when I really kind of steered away from it. But you know, came back and, you know, still as uninformed as I was in high school. But I think, you know, faith is something that's it's hard to articulate. It's not based on logic. It's a leap. So that's where I am.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, weeknights on Comedy Central. It's the same show you love, but with one teeny tiny difference. Introducing The Daily Show with new host Trevor Noah, weeknights on Comedy Central and on the Comedy Central app.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic Jim Gaffigan, who's preparing to perform Saturday for over a million people in Philadelphia as part of the World Meeting of Families, which Pope Francis is expected to attend. The gathering is sponsored by the Pontifical Council for Families. When we left off, he was talking about being raised as a Catholic, but identifying as an agnostic or atheist in his 20s, when becoming a stand-up comic, got him to question everything in his belief system. So comedy took you away from faith. What brought you back to it?
I wouldn't say that comedy brought me away from it. I think that my idea of faith was another obligation in my life. You know, I was raised in a family where my father was the first one to go to college. You sought security. You didn't question, kind of like you would go to college, you would wear a tie to work, you would work for 40 years and then you would play golf for 3 years and then you would die. That was how I was raised. And so I think when my mother died, it was such a shock to the logic that I had been raised with. You know, I wasn't going to church. I never went to church when I was in college either. But I would say my return to my faith is, it's a very personal thing, but I think it was, I reached a point in my life where I didn't really like who I was. And, you know, I had all these things that I wanted. I was married to an amazing woman. I had children. And yet there was frustration. You know, it's kind of hard to articulate, but like this notion of mercy, forgiveness was very appealing for me. It was very profound, and it had a deep impact, and I think it still does.
Lots of your comedy is about being a father with now 5 kids. Did you ever think you'd have as many kids? I know you lived alone for like 13 years, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I love stand-up comedians. I really do. And, even when you hear about a comedian getting married, among comedians, we're always kind of like, what are they doing? And so the idea of having a large family, you know, I definitely had a romantic notion of it, but I didn't think that is something that would happen. I didn't think I would be in the position emotionally or financially to be able to do that. But, you know, I've been lucky. But, there's also, you know, I do get a lot. My children have made me a better man, which is, in the end, that's probably more important than, you know, 2 more comedy specials or being in better shape. So I don't know. I mean, I know it sounds like I'm saying what I'm supposed to say, but, it's really kind of my experience.
So what was it like for you when you got to New York and had to establish a comic identity? I don't know if being Catholic was an issue for you then that you felt like you needed to I'm not sure whether you're in your, agnostic phase or like, let them know I'm Catholic phase. So how did you find who you were on stage in New York?
Well, you know, it's I always had this romantic notion of living in New York. I didn't know. I just felt like, you know, everyone could be different and weird and whatever they are in New York, where I felt like, in the Midwest, as much as I love the Midwest, I felt that I was you know, I was a little bit different. And so when I started stand-up, and this is in the 90s, there was definitely, people hadn't watched decades of Comedy Central work. You know, people are really much more educated on stand-up comedy. It used to be much more of a form of combat. You know, heckling was much more common. And I couldn't get stage time, and so I would go out to Pips in Sheepshead Bay.
Oh, gosh, I grew up in Sheepshead Bay.
Right.
My parents used to go to Pips. I never
right?
went there.
And so, you know, and that's where Andrew Dice Clay kind of, obviously huge
Woody Allen,
history,
I think, started there.
Oh, yeah. And so Richard Lewis, you know, so many greats. And, but like at that time, Pips was very much this rough and tumble kind of, you know, Brooklyn Italian kind of, or Andrew Dice Clay kind of working class thing. And so I came across, I remember that's where I had this realization, to these people, I just look like John Tesh, you know, to this audience. And so, I left the Midwest thinking I didn't fit in. But when I got to New York, I realized how truly Midwestern I was. And so, you know, I grew up 45 minutes outside of Chicago, but there was some of it was this this perception of the Midwest that I realized in this multicultural city that and I don't think it's as true as it was, but everyone was kind of like, what are you, Jewish? Are you Italian? What are you, you know, are you black? Are you Puerto Rican? And so I ended up, my ethnic identity was Midwestern, was white bread. And so it informed a lot of my stand-up.
Part of your thing is that you work clean. You're a clean comic. You don't use four-letter words and stuff. I guess you don't talk about sex explicitly in your performances. That probably has something to do with being invited for Pope Weekend in Philadelphia to perform for the World Meeting of Families with possibly the Pope in the audience. But did you always work that way? Or was that a conscious decision after not working that way?
Well, I was never really that dirty. I definitely had some curse words here and there. And as I mentioned, you know, I curse in everyday life, as my kids will repeatedly tell me. But, you know, I had some jokes that were dirty. And some of it is when I started making appearances on Conan and Letterman back in the late 90s, I think, you had to remove the curse words or you couldn't do some of the more explicit jokes. And I realized in removing or rewriting these jokes that often the jokes weren't done or that I was using, for me, the curse words as kind of a crutch. So then I just started writing. If I knew I was going to be on Conan, you know, every other month, I wasn't going to write a joke that I wouldn't be able to do on Conan. But again, most of my material is, you know, it doesn't necessarily involve a lot of editing. So even the show with, you know, for the World Meeting of Families in Philadelphia, I don't have to worry about some of the material being inappropriate. I mean, I do have some Catholic stuff that is done from the perspective of an ignorant Catholic. But other than that topic-wise, there's nothing really filthy.
In your TV series, your best friend is played by Adam Goldberg, and he's also a comic, but he's not, his career isn't really going anyplace. He's an atheist Jewish person who lives with his mother in a retirement community. And although he lives with his mother in a retirement community, he thinks you're the one who's in a dead end because you're married and have five children and that therefore you must have an awful life. And he has all this like freedom. And you think that that's absurd because he's living with his mother in a retirement community. Is your characterization of this Adam Goldberg best friend in the TV series a reflection of how you think some people look at you?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think I remember, you know, back in being in the Comedy Cellar and Ray Romano before his show having to leave to go home to because he had kids that had to get to school. I remember thinking, that poor guy. So, there's probably a lot more people that identify with Dave, who's played by Adam, on the show than identify with my point of view. And, you know, there is something, you know, where the Dave character is, you know, obviously Adam does such a terrific job with it, but he's both a cautionary tale of what Jim could have been, and also Jim is envious of his freedom and some of the independence and the nomadic nature that Dave kind of his romantic paths take, you know. So, you know, like the Dave character was intentionally constructed because we did want him to be somebody, you know, a voice of the audience, like, Jim, you are a lunatic for having five kids. And also, you know, to represent so many comedians that I know and love.
Support for this podcast comes from AT&T. With AT&T, the network is on demand, so the office is mobile and the cloud is designed for high security. Learn more at att.com/focus.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic Jim Gaffigan, who stars in The Jim Gaffigan Show as a comic who, like Gaffigan, is a husband, father of five, and Catholic. On Saturday, he'll perform in Philadelphia at the pontifical-sponsored event, the World Festival of Families. Pope Francis is expected to be in attendance, along with over a million other people. So how nervous are you about this weekend performing for a huge audience of Catholics who have gathered for the World Meeting of Families? And there's a very good possibility that the Pope will be in the audience, too.
You know, talking about it, doing interviews like this, makes me realize that I should be more prepared. I'm definitely going to be prepared, but I don't, you know, I don't know what I'm going to say when I step on stage, because I'm going to, the environment's going to inform it. And I don't
really
know if,
tell me if that's true, that you really, really yeah. don't, like, when, I can't compare myself to you.
Yeah.
But I know, like, for me, when I have a guest speaker appearance, I need to know the first words I'm going to say, and I need to be confident that I know what they are, and I'm confident that it's going to be okay. Because if I don't have the very beginning, I just feel like I'm going to be lost. I can't afford to stumble with that first sentence. So really, like, you don't know what you're going to say?
Yeah, no, well, you know, I understand your logic, but I also understand that it's 1.5 million people. I also know that there are many things that are going to happen beforehand. Mark Wahlberg is hosting. I know that Aretha
He probably
Franklin,
knows what he's going to say.
He probably does. But I also know that they're not there to see me. You know, I'm going to have to get a semblance of understanding what the task calls for. So am I going to be going for laughs? Am I going to be, you know, but yeah, no, I should. I'll have some ideas. But it's also, you know, irreverence in that situation is, you know, it's like a conversation. What's the most appropriate thing to start with? You know, since it is a world meeting of families, do I start with family material? Do I start with the fact that the Pope is coming? Do I start with the enormity of the audience, or is that going to be too, or is that going to come across as insecure? I mean, look, the Northeast, whether it's New York, Philly, or Boston, from my experience, you don't go out there and appear weak. You go out and you appear strong. And so I would say that informs it also, but some of it is also with, like, you know, from experience from doing TV shows. Don't expect to get a laugh for the first minute. It's like people are going to figure out who you are, what their expectations are. There's going to be people from Latin America and the Philippines in the audience.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that, of course.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's.
So do you have to come out there and go, like, here's who I am? You know, it's to basically establish who you are and why, of all the comics in the world, like, you're there?
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, I could do, you know, that's an approach. Hopefully Mark, I'll say Mark like we're best friends. Mark Wahlberg will say that. And then I'll just try and get free Wahlburgers for the rest of my life. But so he will, but some of it might be, you know, maybe I'll go, you know, trying to get their attention by saying, you know, who's here from South America, who's here from, you know, I don't know. Maybe he would have done that. Or maybe I, you know, like I said, you know, maybe I'll be like, I can't believe I'm here. I've done that in other shows when I've gone on after comedy greats. It's, you know, kind of like letting people know that this is a experience bigger than yourself. I don't know.
What do you do when you have an event that's making you nervous? What do you do to take care of the anxiety?
You know, I would say, you know, preparation, right? But
I'm sorry, you just told us you're not going to know what you're going to say.
I know. No. Believe me. I want to be clear. I'm going to be very prepared, but I'm not. I'm not trying to sound like Mr. Cool. Like I'm going to do all the material. You know, I'm going to be very prepared, but I'm not going to have. You know, I can't commit to what jokes I'm going to do. Any comedian would do this, by the way. This is not me being unique. But I think it's, you know, the weird thing is that I'm somebody who, when I get nervous, I get quieter. So I would say, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, I'm definitely nervous when I perform in certain situations, but you know, I performed at the New York State Fair, which was only 10,000 people. But some of it is people are also going to be in a really good mood. It's, you know, they're going to be very excited to be there. Again, they're not there to see me. So that's a wrinkle in the logic. But it will be a positive experience. You know, but if it's a world meeting of families announcing that I have 5 children and maybe they're going to be receptive to that, announcing that I'm Catholic, that might be. But I don't know what Mark Wahlberg's going to do. I don't know what Aretha Franklin's going to do. She's a wild card. I imagine she'll sing, you know. I don't know.
Well, listen, I wish you really good luck this weekend.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jim Gaffigan will perform in Philadelphia Saturday as part of the pontifical-sponsored World Festival of Families. Over 1 million people, including Pope Francis, are expected to attend. Gaffigan's TV series, The Jim Gaffigan Show, had its first season finale last night. You can see the series on demand. The show has been renewed for a second season. In 1954, the New York drama critics voted The Golden Apple the best musical of the year. It was the first time that an off-Broadway musical had won the award. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says that wasn't the only extraordinary thing about The Golden Apple. And now, the first complete recording of the musical has been released.
The Golden Apple isn't your typical Broadway musical. In fact, it's more of an opera than a musical. Not only the individual songs, but every word is sung. And it's in a tradition of operas inspired by the Trojan War, going back to the 17th century with Monteverdi's The Return of Ulysses. Except that instead of Mount Olympus in Greece, it takes place near Mount Olympus in Washington State after the Spanish-American War. Here, Helen is a bored farmer's daughter, who triggers a war by flying off with a traveling salesman named Paris in his hot air balloon. Unlike its operatic predecessors, The Golden Apple is a musical comedy, so its most immediate ancestors are American folk operas like Porgy and Bess and Virgil Thompson and Gertrude Stein's The Mother of Us All. And it paved the way for later operatic Broadway musicals like Frank Lesser's The Most Happy Fella and Leonard Bernstein's Candide. The composer was Jerome Maras, a Brooklyn-born prodigy who's probably still best known for his music for Hollywood and TV westerns, like the theme for Wagon Train and his Oscar-nominated score for William Wyler's The Big Country. But The Golden Apple is his most ambitious work, and his irresistible tunes are still fresh 60 years later. His librettist, poet John Latouche, was a year younger than Maurras, but died of a sudden heart attack in 1956 at the age of 41. He co-wrote the great lyrics for the 1940 standard Taking a Chance on Love, and later became part of the revolving door of distinguished lyric writers for Candide. The hit song from Golden Apple is Lazy Afternoon, and who could resist Danielle Estes as the steamy Helen on a game-changing new recording?
It's a hazy afternoon, and I know a place that's quiet, except for daisies running riot, and there's no one passing by it to see. Spend this lazy afternoon with me.
Despite its great reviews and awards, and its move from off-Broadway to Broadway, The Golden Apple was not a hit. Latouche said that he and Maurras may have overestimated the theater's burning demand for novelty. I knew the show because there was an original cast album, which is still in print, with wonderful singers like Kay Ballard as Helen and matinee idol Stephen Douglas as Ulysses, who abandons his wife Penelope to retrieve Helen. But that recording has barely half the music, and not all in the right order. A narrator intrudes to describe what's omitted. But a remedy has finally arrived in the form of a 2-CD set of a complete live performance by the Lyric Stage of Irving, Texas, with singers who are also good actors. I love the variety of The Golden Apple. Heartfelt love songs alternate with cutting social and political satire. About, for example, the lame excuses politicians make in order to start a war. There's even a hilarious parody of a South Sea Island number.
Croon a real jungle tune upon that golden shore, kids. We'll lie on beds of orchids, and then later by the crater of the old volcano, we can promise we won't say no one, no one.
At the end, when Ulysses returns from his post-war odyssey, his hard-won reconciliation with Penelope is as moving as the similar scene in Monteverdi some 300 years earlier. Thanks to this complete set, the golden apple is finally all there for us to experience. And it's exciting to discover that all the newly recorded material really adds up to something larger and much more original than just the sum of its most attractive parts.
Lloyd Schwartz teaches creative writing in the MFA program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and writes for the online journal New York Arts. He reviewed the first complete recording of the musical The Golden Apple on the PS Classics label.
Nothing ever happens in Angel's Roost. It nestles where the mountains brush the sky. It has a pretty view, but there's just three things to do. You're born and then you live and then you die. Nothing ever happens in Angel's Roost.
If you'd like to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed, you'll find what you're looking for on our podcast, including our recent interview with Pastor Nadia Boltz-Weber, a former stand-up comic who became an ordained Lutheran minister and started her own church for people like her who are in recovery, dealing with addictions, compulsions, and depression. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.